Thank you again for your invite. I like these kind of informal services. They just give us an opportunity to kind of sit back, relax, and have a little thought about some important things. And the subtitle for this morning's service is Faith in Times of Fear. Now, my experiences will be different to your experiences. I know a few of you, but very few of you. And I don't know the things that you're going through in your lives. What I hope you'll see as I share a little bit about my own life is that we have a God who is dependable and a God who promises to be with us. Now, if you're a Christian, that's an encouraging thing, because although our experiences are different, we can look at God's faithfulness and recognize that he's with us in our difficulties as well. And if you're not a Christian, then I hope you'll find this morning challenging, as it perhaps prompts you to consider whether God is real, and if he is real, whether you can know him. And if you can know him, what difference can he make in your life? So let me start at the beginning. Given you don't know me, I'm just going to introduce myself and my family. This is my wife, Catherine. Catherine grew up here in Bath. She grew up in Fairfield Park, went to Haysfield School. So if any of you are of the same vintage, I won't say how old she is, but 40-ish. Then we're at Haysfield, you may have come across her. The older one on the right is Joshua, he's 12, and Reuben on the left is 9. And Joshua's just started Beeching Cliff, so he's getting his head around senior school. Reuben is at Moorlands, so just down the road, and enjoying life there. Now, my life started a bit further back than this. This was me when I had hair. Okay, I delight in the fact that I had a little Mohican going on when I was young. But I was born in Scotland in 1975, so I'm 42. I actually was born when my parents were back on holiday, I guess. They had been living and working in Bangladesh. This is my family, my mum and dad, and my brother and I. My parents moved to work as missionaries in Bangladesh in 1970. And shortly after they arrived in 1971, they had the War of Independence. Bangladesh at the time, when they got there, was known as East Pakistan. And if any of you have watched your TVs recently and seen the programs about partition in India, it's the 70th anniversary of partition. So India was divided into India and Pakistan in 1947. And it was quite arbitrarily determined where people would go and how the lines would be drawn. In their wisdom, the British decided to divide a country like this. You have India here, and then East and West Pakistan on either side, divided by over 1,000 miles. And that didn't actually work very well. East Pakistan had all of the natural resources. West Pakistan was the seat of power. And East Pakistan and West Pakistan just didn't get on very well. And so in 1971, West Pakistan launched something called Operation Searchlight, where they basically went into East Pakistan intending to kill as many people as they could. And it's estimated that anywhere up to 3 million people were slaughtered in that war. And that was just a few months after my parents arrived, so it was a very tricky time. And millions of people were displaced. A lot of the Hindu population in Bangladesh, or East Pakistan as it was then, moved into India. And finally, with India's help, they intervened in the war and Bangladesh gained independence. But in 1975, my parents came back for a brief holiday. I was delivered by a Bengali doctor in Scotland, which is quite strange, and then went back out when I was a few months old. So this is my brother Colin on the left. Has this got a pointer? There we go. And that's me. And this is where we grew up. We lived in the top floor flat of this house in a place called Kushtia, which is, I guess it's kind of northwestern Bangladesh, a few hours' drive from the Indian border. And we were in a town of, I guess, about, 150,000 people at the time. It's much bigger now. But apart from one other American family, we were the only Westerners in the town. And the only Western kids. So growing up in Bangladesh was actually a lot of fun, because you could wander around anywhere you liked And everyone knew who you were. So if you got lost, they would say, oh, there's the white kids, take them back to their parents. But we loved living there. It was a very simple life, but a very enjoyable life. I don't know how old I am there. Maybe I'm about 4 or 5. But I became a Christian when I was about 7 years old, which is kind of, I guess, roughly what I am here. These were some of our friends in our back garden eating our first chicken that we had killed, well, we'd bought with our money, killed and eaten. But I became a Christian when I was about 7. As I said, my parents were missionaries, so they were quite committed in their faith. And I think the thing that really struck me at that age, because I mean, I don't know how old the kids here are, but at 7 you can't understand an awful lot. But I knew that I had done things that were wrong. And that was quite clear to me. It was no difficult stretch of my imagination to recognize that. And I remember one day, we used to have family devotions, and I remember one day just sitting down with my parents and just saying, actually, I think I need to be forgiven for what I've done. And I could see my parents' relationship with God was something that was very real. I mean, we prayed a lot about things. They always seemed to commit their ways to God, and they'd see God answering prayers. And so this idea that God could relate to us was very real, and I didn't have any question that God existed. So it was a very natural progression for me, having recognized that God was real, to recognize that I needed to know him. And so at the age of 7, I remember praying with my mum and asking God to forgive me and to help me to follow him and to live for him. Now, at the age of 7, my mum had been homeschooling my brother and myself. Colin was 9, I was 7. And I think at that point she felt her abilities were rather stretched, and she wasn't going to be able to teach us anymore. So we had to work out what we were going to do for schooling. And Bangladesh at the time didn't have any schools at all that would prepare us for coming back to the UK. And so the decision was either we all have to come back to the UK at this point, or we explore some other options. And one of the options was a Christian boarding school in South India. And this was 1,500 miles away, and we were quite young. And it was a big choice for us to make as a family. And we went there on holiday and had a look, and my brother and I loved it. We decided we'd like to go here. But I remember the day we were to leave Kushtia, where we were living, to make our first journey to India. And I remember it because it sticks in my mind, because it was a day in which I saw God clearly answer prayer for, not for the first time, but in a way that really stuck in my mind. We had a long day's journey ahead of us because we had to drive from Kushtia to Dhaka, which is the capital city, and it's about a day's journey. And we had a Land Rover, and we had to cross over a couple of rivers on the ferries and get there. We had to get to the first ferry on time, otherwise the whole journey would be delayed. And everything was packed in the car, we were ready to go, and then we couldn't find the keys for the Land Rover. And so we kind of split up, and we started looking around, and we spent about 20 minutes searching high and low everywhere for these keys, and we just couldn't find them. And so we sat down in my parents' room, and we said, okay, we've just got to pray about this. Let's pray about it and ask God to help us. And so we sat down as a family, and we prayed, said, Lord, please, we've got to make this journey. We've got to get going. Help us to find these keys. We opened our eyes, and the keys were literally sitting on the dresser in front of us. Now, either we just had looked terribly badly and just hadn't seen them, but they were so obviously sitting there in the room. And I remember seeing them and then just saying, Mom, we found the keys. Let's sing and tell God how pleased we are that he's helped us. And we sang a song, Bless the Lord, O My Soul, which you may know. It became my mum's favorite song. But it was a point at which God answered a prayer so clearly for us that it was almost as if he was saying to us, you're about to embark on a new stage in your life. I know this is going to be a hard time for your family. And right at the very beginning, I want you to know that I'm a God who can look after you, a God who can do miracles, a God who will be with you. And so that spoke to me right at the beginning of my Christian life, that God is a God who hears and answers prayer, and a God who cares about us in all the things that we do. This was where we were living, around about here, and we had to take a 3-day journey by train all the way down through India, down to a place called Tamil Nadu. We had to change a couple of trains, and our final train took us 8,000 feet up into the hills of South India to one of the old hill stations called Uti, which had been set up by the British Raj. And here's Uti. It's a lot bigger now than it used to be, but at the time it was a beautiful respite up in the hills, surrounded by the tea gardens, and just a lovely place to go to school. And I really enjoyed it. It was a Christian school. I had some dorm parents who looked after me that I almost think of as second parents now. Really good, godly people who encouraged me as I was growing up. When I was 15 and my brother was 17, Colin had finished his GCSEs, and we were trying to work out what we should do as a family. Colin was wanting to go into university a little bit later, and we felt it'd be easier for us to settle back into life in the UK if we came back at the end of GCSEs, rather than doing A-levels and then coming back. So we all returned to Scotland in the summer of 1990, and I decided actually that I'd like to finish my GCSEs back in India. So at the end of the summer holidays, Colin and my parents found somewhere to live in Scotland, and I decided to return to India. When we got to the airport at Heathrow, I remember we sat down as a family and we prayed, and we had something we called our family verse. And our family verse was a verse that we used to recite together whenever we were saying our goodbyes. So whenever we went off to boarding school or whatever it was, we'd sit down and we'd remind ourselves of some truths in the Bible. And this is the verse that we used to say together. God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. So we can say with confidence that the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? And I remember we said this together, and my dad said, Alan, remember this, that God is with you. He's your helper. You have nothing to fear. Okay, you're making this big journey by yourself, but you have nothing to fear. God is with you. And then we turn to Psalm 139, which is one of our favorite psalms, and we read these verses. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, and your right hand will hold me fast. And I remember my dad saying, Alan, even if you rise on the wings of British Airways, God is with you. And no matter where you are, he promises to be with you. So as I left, I had these promises in my mind. God is with me. He cares about me. There's nothing that can happen to me that's outside of his control. And off I went. I went through security and got into the departure lounge, and suddenly discovered that our plane was delayed. No big deal. It was just an air conditioning problem. And so while I was waiting, I bumped into an old school friend of mine, a guy called Joshua, who was in the same class as me at Hebron School in India. And so he was there with his parents. They were Indian by birth, but 4 out of 5 of them had American nationality. So they were coming from the States, heading on to India on the same flight as me. So God had provided for me some companionship. We finally got on the plane, and the route was to fly to Bombay via Kuwait, where we would refuel. And so it must have been the evening of the 1st of August 1990. We got on our flight and flew off to Kuwait. The early hours of the 2nd of August 1990, we landed in Kuwait, and we had the option to get off the plane and to wander around, which I took. So I got my hand luggage, and I got off the plane, and I had a little wander around the airport. Now, it was very strange. I know it was the early hours of the morning, but the airport was completely desolate. There was no one else there, no other flights, no buzz of people walking around, running around like you normally get in an airport. It was just deathly quiet. And so I wandered around a bit. Everything seemed to be shut. And 20 minutes later, I came back to get back on my flight. As I walked towards the departure gate, suddenly there was a massive screaming. And everyone who had been on my flight that hadn't got off were running off the plane, screaming and shouting, saying, get away from the windows, get away from the windows. So I ran to the windows to see what was going on. And I looked out, and you could see these jets flying over and dropping bombs and these massive explosions going off all around us. And so I quickly got away from the windows, and we huddled in a corner, not knowing what was going on. And we must have been sat there for about half an hour until the bombing had completely ceased and everything seemed to have settled down again. And these soldiers turned up, who I suspected were Kuwaitis or Kuwaiti police officers. I wasn't really sure, but these guys turned up and said, "Look, you can't obviously fly because the airport has been bombed. We're going to take you to the airport hotel in Kuwait." So we got on these buses and were taken to the airport hotel in Kuwait. And I remember I shared a room with my friend Joshua, and I just remember chatting that night with him, saying, "Wow, this is going to be amazing when we get back to school and tell our friends what's just happened." And so we had, it was great. It was that kind of thing. This is a brilliant experience. We can tell people all about it. The next morning we woke up and discovered that Saddam Hussein had just invaded Kuwait. And he had more than 100,000 troops had crossed the border into Kuwait, more than 2,000 tanks. This is what happened to my plane. It basically got bombed and destroyed. And this is what I saw, basically, that kind of scene when I looked outside my window the following morning. Tanks heading up towards the hotel, helicopters flying around, troops firing guns all over the place, and it was just complete mayhem. And this is when I realized that actually it wasn't going to be quite as simple as I thought. We probably weren't going to just hop on a plane onto India and tell everyone our story. We saw this, and everyone in the hotel started to realize things were a little bit more dangerous than maybe we had expected. Shortly later, I heard some gunfire downstairs, and then we were called down to the lobby of the hotel, and one of the Iraqi generals, as we soon discovered it was what had happened, that Iraq had invaded Kuwait, one of the Iraqi generals basically explained to us what had happened and said that we wouldn't be able to fly home immediately, so we'd have to stay in this hotel until that was possible. So we were in this hotel for about a week, and they would feed us in the morning, feed us at night time. It was no great hardship, really, other than the fact that I think people's stress levels were quite high. But in my hand luggage, I had my Bible, and I had loads of sweets that I was going to take to my friends, which never got there. But I had my Bible, and I used to read my Bible each morning and pray and ask God to be with me. I had the promises in my mind that God has said, "Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. So even if the things fall down around you, what can man do to me?" So I had these promises, and I knew that God was with me. And actually, I never felt scared. I can honestly say, hand on heart, that I never felt scared. There were times when I felt lonely, but I never feared for my life. Others did. There were people who had numerous heart attacks while they were there. Lots of people were given cigarettes to help ease their nerves and things. But anyway, after a week, again, we were called down to the lobby, and the Iraqi general told us to head to two sides of the room. All the Westerners, they wanted on one side, and Asian, African nationalities, they wanted on the other side. It was a bit arbitrary. We didn't know why they were doing this, but they said they wanted to take the Westerners to the airport first, and they would release us, and the Asian and African hostages would then be released afterwards. At this point, I got separated from my friends, because one of them, the father, was Indian. He didn't have American nationality, and they didn't want to get split up, so they destroyed their passports and just pretended that they were all Indian and stuck together. So at this point, I got separated. We were put on buses, and I assumed I was going to get taken to the airport hotel. Instead, I was taken on a 6-7 hour bus ride up to Basra in southern Iraq. This isn't actually a picture of when I was there, but it became known as the Highway of Death. If you remember during the Gulf War, that route between Kuwait and Baghdad, or Basra in southern Iraq, just completely wrecked by bombs, and everywhere you looked, there were just burnt-out vehicles and so on. But when I did go up there had been a lot of, I guess, lorries and things that had been going the opposite way to the tanks as they came down. They'd just been completely blasted out of existence. But we spent 6 or 7 hours in 52 degrees heat going up to Basra, and when we arrived in Basra, we were put on an overnight guarded train to Baghdad. What they explained to us was that given the airport had been bombed in Kuwait, we wouldn't actually be able to fly out of Kuwait. So the need was to take us to Baghdad and fly us from Baghdad. So we were taken to a place called the Al Mansour Melia Hotel in Baghdad. And this was a big sort of collecting point for all of the hostages. There were probably, I guess, about 400 of us confined to the top, maybe 3 or 4 floors of this hotel. We were allowed out for a few hours each morning to get some exercise and some fresh air. And again, you know, we were fed pretty well, and I didn't feel anxious or nervous. I guess partly when you're 15, you have a little sense of adventure and you perhaps are shielded from some of the seriousness of the situation you're in. But equally, I think God protected my heart and kept me from fear. But we were in this place for about 10 days. And at one point while we were there, the British ambassador was allowed to come and visit us. Now, he didn't get to speak to each one of us, but he came with a whole host of telegrams and things to be distributed to the hostages. And my parents had been allowed to send a telegram in the hope that maybe it would get to me. And it did get to me. And if you remember telegrams, it's not like emails where you can just send masses and masses of words. You're restricted in what you can say. And so my parents said, "Dear Alan, remember our family verse and remember that there are thousands of people praying for you all over the world." And that was it. And that brought great comfort to me, because as I had been reading my Bible, I'd been finding a great deal of comfort that God was with me, He was watching over me. And the reminder that not only God was with me, but people all over the world were praying for me, was a great encouragement to me. Now, my parents didn't know anything about my situation in terms of whether I was alive or if I was dead. They knew I didn't arrive in India, but after that they knew nothing about me. And so for them it was an extremely difficult time, because when I got back later, I remember chatting to my brother, and he said they used to go up into the hills near where they were in Scotland, into the moors, and just go for a walk as a family, and my parents trying to explain to Colin that I might not come back, and that they had to trust that God was sovereign in this, and that He would do what was right. So for them, I think in many ways it was more difficult than it was for me. We were at this place for about 10 days, and again one day we were called down to the lobby, and we were told we were going to be released. And there was a lot of excitement. People were finally thinking, great, we're going to get home. And they called out our names, and as they called out our names, you had to walk to the front and then get on a bus. And there were maybe, I don't know, 20 buses, loads of coaches. And the buses were all blacked out, so you couldn't really see where you were going. But in my window, there was just a little crack in the kind of tinting, so I could see out. And as we were driving along, I could see signs for Baghdad Airport. And so I was quite hopeful that we were going to be released. And then we came to this junction, and Baghdad Airport was off that way. And we took a turning this way, and it was signposted for Babylon. And we were taken somewhere outside the city to a deserted army barracks next to some kind of factory. We didn't know what it was. But say we were taken, not everyone was taken. They started to spread us out across Baghdad. You know the term the human shield, which certainly got popularized during the Iraq war. We were used as a human shield to protect sites that the Western allies might want to bomb and destroy. We were here for just a couple of days. This place, we were in, as I said, these deserted army barracks, and the soldiers plied us with cigarettes because a lot of people were getting really anxious and stressed, and we would sleep on the floors or on sofas, and it's quite basic, but again, they brought us some food in the morning and the evening, and a couple of days later, they came with more buses. So our group that was there must have been maybe 80 to 100 people, and then we split into smaller groups, and we were taken next to an office block on some kind of factory complex. And the Iraqi guards there had gas masks. So we assumed that there must be some kind of chemical weapons, which actually was possible because at that time, Iraq did have chemical weapons. Subsequently, they destroyed them. So people were really getting quite anxious, quite fearful about what might happen. I shared a room with a guy who was probably my age now, in his 40s. It wasn't the easiest. I mean, he was a nice enough guy, but he was very, very negative about our situation. And he used to make fun of me as he saw me read my Bible, because he said, "What do you think God is going to do? We're going to be here for a long, long time, and God's not going to save you." So I remember at this place one day, just starting to feel really lonely. And as I sat down to read my Bible, I just burst into tears. And as I was crying, I just prayed, "God, please show me that you're with me. I've got these promises in the Bible that we read as a family, and things that I know are true, but I just feel really lonely. Please show me that you're with me." And I then opened the Bible, and the passage I was reading that day was the story of Daniel in the lion's den. Now, I didn't understand all the things related to that story. I assumed when Daniel was in the lion's den, he was a young kid. Actually, he was in his 80s. But Daniel was a teenager taken captive in Babylon. And I was a teenager in Babylon. And Daniel was thrown into prison, into this lion's den, even though he did nothing wrong. And here I was in a position that I wouldn't have chosen, yet I had done nothing wrong. And I saw these similarities between Daniel's situation and my situation. There was Daniel thousands of years before me in the same place, and God delivered him. And here I was thousands of years later, the same God. And I remember, again, just crying as I thought it through. And I had this strong sense that God was saying to me, within 3 days something is going to happen. Now, it's not been my experience of God dealing with me like that before. I've never sensed with such certainty that God was speaking to me, saying that something was going to happen. And so I kind of brushed it off. And I thought, well, you know, God doesn't really act like that. He doesn't generally intervene in that way. 2 days later, I was sitting, the Iraqi guards had given us a washing machine because we just had the clothes that we were wearing and a few bits that had been donated to us. And if any of you gents have ever tried to use a washing machine, you'll appreciate it's almost impossible. And I was trying to work out how to use it in Arabic. I had these instructions. And I was sitting there on the washing machine, had no idea what I was doing. And this guy suddenly walked in, surrounded by guards. And as he walked past, I sort of nodded and I said hello. And one of the guards grabbed me and said, "This is Saddam Hussein, the president of Iraq. And he wants to speak to you." So I said, okay. So we went into this room and all the hostages gathered together. We sat down on the floor and Saddam Hussein spoke to us for about an hour, saying how he was very sorry that we were there and it was all the fault of George Bush Senior and Margaret Thatcher and just all kinds of ridiculous things, really. I didn't really know much about him, to be quite honest. He hadn't been massively in the news before he invaded Kuwait because people weren't actually expecting that he would do it. So anyway, he spoke to us for about an hour and then people had the opportunity to ask questions. And then at the end, he said that they were actually filming this whole event. And they said that they were going to broadcast it. And I didn't really believe them. So I was sitting down in a corner looking quite bored, just as he rambled on. But then they said they're going to take a picture and it will be distributed worldwide. And I figured there's more chance that this might happen. So I leapt over the sofa, stood right behind Saddam Hussein. So there I am, just there. And I thought, right, at least my parents might see me and know that I'm okay. So we had this group photo, and then he came around to shake our hands. And this lady here, her name is Pat Morton, and when Saddam Hussein came around and shook my hand, she suddenly said, "Mr. President, this boy is only 15. His parents don't know if he's alive or if he's dead. Is there anything that you can do for him?" And the room just went deathly quiet. And he said something to the interpreter, who looked stunned, and then the interpreter turned to me and said, "The president of Iraq has just asked if you'd like to go home." And so I became the very first Western hostage to be released from Iraq. Now, this was 2 days after I had had that time reading the Bible and sensing that God was speaking to me. Within half an hour, I was taken back to the first hotel, the Al-Mansur Emilia Hotel in Baghdad, where we had all been collected, and I spent a night there. And then I was released the following day, 3 days later. I, of course, said yes, I'd love to go home. The other hostages were less certain because they didn't trust him. and didn't know whether actually he was just going to take me and put me somewhere else. But anyway, the hostages all had a very brief amount of time to write letters, which I took home to distribute to their families. And when I was taken to the airport the following morning, this Iraqi general or officer, whoever it was that took me, he gave me this envelope, and it had $500 in it. And he said, "This is a present from Saddam Hussein for all the troubles that you've gone through and the fact that you've lost your luggage." And it's a generous man. So, and they said, "What we're going to do is we're going to put you on a plane to Jordan. And when you arrive in Jordan, just find someone and tell them you've been released." So I go on this plane, and as you can imagine, it's a little bit nerve-wracking when you don't know the place you're going to. You've got $500 in your pocket, but you've got to get yourself back to England somehow. And I didn't know what was going to happen. So I remember praying on the plane, "Lord, please help me, because I don't know what I'm going to do when I land in Jordan." And I landed in Jordan, and you know the big kind of arms that come up to the plane, whatever they're called. And I stepped off the plane, and I saw these two British Airways officers. And so I went up to them, just about to introduce myself and start this long story of who I was and what I was doing. And they said, "You must be Alan." "Yes!" And I said, "Yes, it's me. How do you know?" And they said, "Well, the British Airways crew, who had also been captured, they'd been kept at the Al Mansour Amelia Hotel in Iraq. I had met them the day I was released by Saddam Hussein, and they had been allowed to phone ahead to say I was being released. So British Airways had contacted my parents. My parents had asked them to get me home safely." And so I was taken, because I was the first release, there was a huge media interest, and all the sort of old reporters, K80, and that generation of people were there trying to speak to me. So they had to fly me in a roundabout direction because everyone was trying to pester me on the plane, which was quite fun again, sitting in first class, seat 1A. And then part of the flight, back in the day when you were still allowed to go into the cockpit, I went from Jordan to Saudi Arabia, and then from Saudi Arabia to London. And for most of that second leg of the journey, I flew in the cockpit so that the reporters wouldn't hassle me. But anyway, what I learned was that God is a God who is actually a faithful God, and he cares about us, and he is sovereign over the affairs of the world. You have despots and dictators who think that they are in control, and yet there is a God who is above and beyond that. And so I guess one of the lessons I learned there that has really stuck with me is that God is dependable. That verse, "God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you," is absolutely true. Even if I hadn't been released, that would have been absolutely true, that he was with me and he never left me. And we can say with confidence, "The Lord is my helper. There's no need to be afraid. What can man do to me?" You know, Saddam had no control over my life, only God did. So I learned a valuable lesson there of God's faithfulness and his care. This was me on my way home. I want to fast forward 22 years. Just to bring things a little bit up to date. I don't have a beard there. I look a bit younger. But I had just had a little operation. You can see some bandage under my top there. In July 2012, I was diagnosed with bowel cancer. I was 37 years old, which is quite a young age to get bowel cancer. And I'd actually been having checkups for 2 or 3 years. So really the idea of checkups is that it prevents you, you know, from getting anything serious. By the time they decided to operate on me, it was a little bit late because they discovered I had stage 3 bowel cancer. And I was told I had a 60 to 70% chance of being okay, which is pretty good odds. But when you're in a room of 10 people and you think 3 of you aren't going to make it, you look at it a little bit differently, don't you? What I learned as a 7-year-old when we lost our keys, and what I learned as a 15-year-old when God delivered me in Iraq, was really precious to me when I got cancer 5 years ago. I'm sure many of you here will either have had cancer yourself or know people who have had cancer. In fact, I think cancer research say that 1 in every 2 people are going to get it. So it's something that affects all of us. But it's not just cancer. There's all kinds of things. There are people who have ongoing problems that just go on forever and ever and ever and really affect their life. I remember when I had cancer, someone giving me a book on Psalm 27 by a guy called Paul Tripp. And I just want to share a few verses from Psalm 27, if that's all right, about some things that I learned. The context of Psalm 27 is about a guy called David. If you don't know the story, he eventually became the king of Israel. But David he'd been anointed to become the new king of Israel, but the old king Saul wasn't happy about that, and he was out to kill David. And the context of this psalm is that Saul is chasing David, and David is probably up in the mountains trying to hide from Saul as Saul and his men are chasing him. And into that context, he writes these words: "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?" Now, the first thing to notice there is that we have complete confidence because of who it is that we trust in. David trusted in the Lord, okay, the God who had always been with him in his life, the God who could be depended on in every situation. And he talks about God in three ways. He says he's my light, my salvation, and my stronghold. If you wander down a path at nighttime without a light, you're very likely to stand in something in the countryside, aren't you? It's very difficult to see where you're going. But when you've got a bright light, suddenly everything becomes clear. You can see the obstacles that are in your way, the kind of strange noises that you hear in the dark that frighten you. Suddenly you see what's making them, and it takes away your fear. When it says that the Lord is my light, it's not like a light dim torch that is shining in front of us. It's like the sun shining in its noonday strength. When we know the Lord as our light, he's there to guide our paths and to show us the way ahead. It talks about the Lord as our salvation. David didn't fully appreciate what that meant. But those of us who are 2,000 years after the life of Jesus appreciate that the most important thing for each one of us is the fact that if we know Jesus, we have been saved from eternity apart from him. We may go through difficult times in our lives. We may go through things that are extremely fearful or upsetting or difficult. But because Jesus has saved us from hell and all that that means, complete separation from God, we have absolutely nothing to fear. Whom shall I fear if God has saved me? Yeah. And of course, we're saved because of the cross. When we think about the struggles that we're facing, we only have to look at the cross for it to speak to us about a God who understands suffering, a God who showed his absolute love and compassion for us. The cross tells me two things about myself. It tells me that I'm worse than I think I am. I am much worse than I think I am. I look at my life and I might think I'm a fairly decent person. But the cross tells me that's not true. The cross tells me that I'm depraved inside. And I have done things that are an abomination to God, and I need forgiveness for it. Secondly, it tells me that there is a solution to my depravity. And that solution is Jesus. Jesus died on the cross to bear the wrath that I deserve upon himself. Now, there's a lot, if you haven't heard that before, there's a lot to try and understand about that, and I'd be very happy to talk in more depth about it. But when we talk about God as our salvation, we have complete confidence in the future because of what Jesus did on the cross. And thirdly, he's the stronghold of my life. A stronghold speaks of somewhere that is safe and secure, a place that we can go and be under absolute protection. If you think of a nuclear bunker, somewhere that has walls that are wider than this room and just can't be destroyed by anything. That sense of a stronghold, that's what God is to his people. So I find that extremely comforting when I was going through cancer. Here's a guarantee, though. The Psalms are very honest. And there's a promise almost here that we are going to face difficult times. It says, when the wicked advance against me, and though an army besiege me. Every one of us here are going to come through times of difficulty in our lives. And that's just a given. We're all going to face difficulties. And this verse talks about two kinds of difficulties. It talks about, well, two kinds of fear, really. It talks about an army besieging him, and it talks about war breaking out against him. Now, if you imagine David up in the mountains, and he can see Saul's army all around him, and he's looking down in anticipation of what lies ahead. You know, if you if you're waiting for some results from the doctor, that sense of anticipation of what might be, that sense of fear of the unexpected, okay? That is one of the kinds of fear that we all face, just like David does here. As he looks across the valley and he sees all of Saul's armies on their way out to get him, the There's that sense of foreboding. And we all feel that at times. And then there is a sense of fear when actually war breaks out against us, when you're right in the middle of the situation. And they're both equally difficult in different ways. But through it all, he says he will be confident. And then he goes on to say one of the most remarkable things I've ever heard in the Psalms. If you imagine being in that position of absolute terror and running for your life, to then turn around and say, one thing I ask from the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. If I had one thing I was going to pray for in the middle of my struggle, it probably wouldn't have been that. I probably would have said, Lord, please strike down Saul. Please deliver me. Please whisk me up in a chariot and take me away from here. Do something. But I probably wouldn't have prayed that. But this reflects something about David's heart, and it actually is a challenge to my own heart. When I'm going through a difficult time, what is the desire of my heart? Is it simply to be saved from what I'm going through? Or is it actually that I might see Jesus, and that I might delight in him and gaze upon him and dwell with him? Because ultimately, he is the one that is going to be with us and protect us and guide us. And then we have this promise. In the day of trouble, he will keep me safe. He will hide me. He will set my feet upon a rock. We have absolute confidence in a God who is there to shelter us and look after us. This actually uses three different words that speak of a shelter. One of them is to do with a shepherd's hut, that a shepherd might take a sick sheep to in the heat of the sun, a place of protection and security. One of the other words used is of the king's tent that is right in the middle of the army. It's a place of complete security. So if you are sensing any, if there's any sense of danger, the king will be in his tent with all his armies around him. No one can get to him. So David has this desire for God, and he has this promise that God is going to be with him. But the end of the psalm finishes like this. It says, wait for the Lord, be strong, and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord. Sometimes we have to wait when we're going through difficult times. But the promise is that God is with us, and we just need to give it to him and trust in him. Now, you may be someone who already knows Jesus, and if you are, then I pray that that would be an encouragement to you. That though your circumstances are different from mine, we have the same God. He is the same God who is faithful and with us in all that we go through. So be encouraged. Be encouraged to make him the desire of your heart. Be encouraged to make him the first and foremost in your life. And trust him, because although this world may be full of struggles, there is the promise of something else. This is the end of the Bible. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. These are familiar words, aren't they? Death shall be no more. There shall be no mourning, no crying, no pain. For the former things have passed away. That is our ultimate confidence. Not this life, but the life to come. And if you don't yet know Jesus, then can I encourage you to explore some of the things I've challenged you about, particularly looking at the cross and why Jesus had to die. And you may know people here who would be happy to talk that through with you. If you don't, then either you can find one of them or find me. I'd be very happy to talk that through with you afterwards. But we have a God who is worthy of our worship, worthy of our giving our lives to him. And I pray that we might do that. And I hope this has been an encouragement to you, and that God might continue his work in each of our lives. Thank you. Yes. Let me close in prayer. And I'd say if anyone wants to read any more, there are some leaflets like this at the back that you might find helpful to look through that will explain some of the things I've touched on. Let's just pray. Father God, we trust in you because you are a dependable Father. You withhold nothing that is good from your children. You do allow us to face times of difficulty because we're in a world that is full of difficulty. And in that difficulty, we can be an example to those who don't know Jesus to show the difference that he makes. We pray for the strength to do that. We pray for the conviction that Jesus is the answer to our solution, to our problems. We pray that we might live for him and delight in him, that he would be our one thing. He would be our one desire, that above all else, above all the trappings of this life, He would be the thing that we live for. Lord, I pray that You'd go with us and depart us in Your peace. And for any, Lord, who today are going through particularly difficult times or have been enduring suffering for a long time, I pray that You might bring them Your peace and the quiet confidence that You are sovereign in their lives and You will do what is right for their good. For I ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.